managing money, it's a bit more like entering a dark room, and you know you've got to get to the other side, and you know there's lots of obstacles in the way. And one thing you don't do is go, well, we've identified our path we're going to take and we're going to stick to it. So you navigate a bit, you hit an obstacle, you work your way around it. And I think that's how a lot of successful money managers operate in practice. They might, in terms of describing what they're doing, go heavy on the big theme stuff because it's fascinating and it's really interesting, but it's not necessarily the major source of returns for that many managers.
Imagine spending an hour with the world's greatest traders. Imagine learning from their experiences, their successes, and their failures. Imagine no more. Welcome to Top Traders Unplugged, the place where you can learn from the best hedge fund managers in the world so you can take your manager due diligence or investment career to the next level. Before we begin today's conversation, remember to keep two things in mind. All the discussion we'll have about investment performance is about the past, and past performance does not guarantee or even infer anything about future performance. Also understand that there's a significant risk of financial loss with all investment strategies, and you need to request and understand the specific risks from the investment manager about their product before you make investment decisions. Here's your host, veteran hedge fund manager, Niels Kastrup Larsen.
For me, the best part of my podcasting journey has been the opportunity to speak to a huge range of extraordinary investors from all around the world. In this series, I have invited one of them, namely Alan Dunn, to host a series of in-depth conversations on the topic of what it takes to be a world-class allocator. In today's world, portfolio construction is fast moving to the top of the agenda of many investors as they try to analyze and understand the riskiness of their portfolios. And with ever-increasing uncertainty around the globe, being well-diversified across many different strategies and themes in your portfolio can mean the difference between ruin and survival when the next crisis emerges. The aim of these conversations is to try and understand the experiences that have influenced these highly specialized allocators and the processes they follow to harness the best returns for their clients so that we can all become better informed investors. And with that, please welcome Alan Dunn.
Thanks for the introduction, Niels. Today, I'm joined by Richard Irwin. Richard is chairman of the investment committee at Saranac Partners in London. Saranac Partners is a UK wealth management firm managing $6 billion in assets under management and advice. Prior to joining Saranac, Richard was head of the outsourced CIO function at BlackRock in Europe, responsible for $80 billion of assets, and prior to that, he was head of economics and asset allocation at Gartmore Fund Managers. Earlier in his career, he spent time at Warburgs and at the Bank of England. Richard, great to have you with us today. How are you?
I'm good, thanks, and great pleasure to be with you. Thank you for having me on.
Not at all. Well, I gave a brief introduction, and obviously you've had a lengthy and distinguished career, I think it's fair to say. Tell us, in your own words, how you got involved in economics and markets and what's brought you to the role at Saranac.
Well, I got into it by being slightly unimaginative, and I did an economics degree. I did some postgraduate work, and then I joined the Bank of England as an economist. That was something I was always interested in, I wanted to do. I spent 6 years at the bank, a fascinating place to work. While I was there, I was the bank's US economist. I worked on UK monetary policy. And then help to coordinate the bank's world economic forecast. So all interesting experiences. Warburgs was interesting because that was a shift away from being just a specialist economist and focusing more on the application to markets. Gartmore, when I joined, was one of the big four institutional managers of money in the UK. And I was very heavily involved in asset allocation there. And did a few other things. I think the most interesting one there was setting up an in-house fund of hedge funds because there are a number of hedge funds within Gartmore, and we put them together in a fund of funds. That worked out well. Interesting thing to do. And I joined BlackRock to work in general on multi-asset issues. But after I'd been there for a couple of years, there was an area which seemed to be growing very quickly. And this is institutional investors running complex portfolios who needed some help in doing so. And when I joined, there was one client who fitted that category, And I started working on that full time after I'd been at BlackRock for a couple of years. And we built up that business to over 20 clients and $80 billion. So those are the three main phases prior to joining Saranac.
Good stuff. And obviously now in this wealth management business. So tell us a bit about Saranac and what the approach is there and what your own role is.
So I think we're probably getting close to the 10th anniversary of the gestation of Saranac as an idea. So some current colleagues who I've worked with ever since I've been at Saranac were working in the wealth management division of a large bank, and they felt that it was not possible in that framework to service higher income clients. So they thought there was a gap in the market to service the high wealth brackets, and Saranac was set up to be the partner of choice for individuals, families, family offices, and business owners. And that was, say, the genesis of the idea was 10 years ago. We started managing money in 2017 and have been doing so ever since. I was about to say that Saranac was a startup, but given that we've been going for quite a long time, I think it's no longer a startup. A big boutique, yes, startup, no.
Okay, and you're chair of the investment committee, and I think you're responsible for asset allocation. So, I mean, obviously you come from very much an institutional background. Has that been a notable shift being in the private wealth industry, or do you think it's same problem for everybody?
I think at some fundamental level, all investors are trying to do the same thing, which is to get as much return as possible for as little risk as possible. And I think that very high-level generic objective translates across all investors. But there are some differences. I think the biggest one is on the institutional side, particularly pension funds. We're running quite complex LDI overlays. Obviously got a bad name when we had the Liz Truss fiasco a couple of years ago, but actually these were quite integral to the management of many pension funds, and most of them didn't have an issue at that time. But those are just not needed for in the private wealth sector. I think the big difference I'd probably draw attention to is obviously there's a diversity of clients on the institutional side, but I think there's a greater diversity of clients in private wealth. So the range of things that people are trying to achieve is much more varied. I would say the tolerance for risk and return varies. I mean, we run money for clients just running cash plus strategies, like treasury management. We run very aggressive risk-on portfolios for people who want the high returns. So to me, the big difference is we have to cater at Saranac, and it was the reason it was set up, for a very wide range of idiosyncratic bespoke portfolios. And going back to why Saranac was set up, it was felt that in a large bank, the solutions offered to clients tend to be too limited. So whatever the question was, the answer was pretty much the same. Whereas we're dealing with a much broader range of issues and we run much more bespoke portfolios. So I think, to my mind, that's the big difference.
Okay, interesting. And I guess, is there a unifying philosophy or framework that you bring in terms of the investment approach? Obviously, for different clients, different mandates, there's different risk tolerances and investment objectives, but would you say there's a particular philosophy around how you invest, or would that be fair to say?
I think we've got different processes in different areas, but I think that there is sufficient difference between the different areas that it's either very hard to have an overriding philosophy or it's just not necessary to have one. So I think the overriding philosophy is probably much more at the commercial level, which is we're going to spend a long time with our clients trying to understand what they're trying to do and help them to achieve that in the most effective way. So I think that that's the unifying factor. But if I look at the way that we manage money directly, so it's very difficult to say that the fixed income mandates are managed in the same way as the equity mandates, because it's hard to find a common factor. So the common factor would be, let's try and manage them well, which to me means explaining how we're going to run those mandates. understanding the client's risk tolerance and deliver on those grounds. But sadly, no overriding investment philosophy which covers the very wide range of asset classes we're involved in, including private markets as well.
Okay, so it sounds like you're using all the levers available to you. Presumably, you're using active and passively managed funds, and you're using individual securities, and you're doing some in-house and some externally. Is that fair to say you're using all of the above?
Yeah, I think that's right. So we're very clear that we think that we can do some investment management in-house. So as I say, I think we've got a pretty good track record in fixed income, in equities, in multi-asset. But again, depending on the client, we don't have an aversion to passive mandates at all. So why would some clients have passive mandates in their portfolios and others be active? And I think it comes down to a couple of things. One is cost. And if you're a large investor these days and you're investing in large cap equities, you can probably get your passive exposure a couple of basis points. It's incredibly cheap. Active managers charge more than that. I would say that most of the time, the passive managers are going to be somewhere in the second quartile. Last year, depending on which particular area of equity markets you're invested in, it might even be first quartile, given the nature, concentrated nature of markets. So there's nothing wrong with passive because it's cheap, you know what you're going to get, and you don't have to do much oversight on it. But this doesn't mean that there's a big theological debate, as far as we see it, between active and passive. So why would you be active? It's because you want to do better than that benchmark return. And finding managers who do that is not straightforward. It's not axiomatic that if you're an asset manager, you outperform. But we have respectable performance and equities in that area. There are other managers who also have respectable performance. In particular, I'm just talking about equities here to illustrate it. I won't go through every asset class, but we don't really have the expertise to do a lot of security selection in emerging markets. And over the past few years, sometimes we've been passive there, sometimes we've used active managers. But the choice between the two tends to be very much on pragmatic grounds rather than active management is good and passive is bad or vice versa. And I think the whole industry has moved on in that way. I can remember back in the 90s, it was much more of a theological debate. But I think there's a recognition, particularly given the rise of ETFs, that now that you can break down the equity indices so much, the distinction between active and passive is getting pretty blurred anyway.
Interesting. Well, maybe just to kick off into the kind of the investment discussion. I mean, you've been in the industry a long time doing asset allocation a long time. So, I mean, from the perspective of where we are at the moment, it strikes me it's, you know, quite a changed environment maybe to what we were in, during the 2010s. But a lot of debate still around, have we seen a structural shift or, you know, was it more of, you know, a transitory a bump in markets linked to COVID, et cetera, and that will eventually move back to kind of the low rates world. How do you see that and how does that kind of inform your asset allocation thinking?
Well, I think then it's difficult. By the way, let me take a step back here. So we don't see there being a huge differentiation between asset allocation and some of the investment decisions that we take. Country selection in equities will tend to lead to our equity team because they're better placed to take them. So occasionally we might run overlays, but a lot of the time we don't. So we don't see a hard and fast distinction between asset allocation and security selection. There's a gray area there. And what we're trying to do is understand that where we've got themes in portfolios, let's be careful that we're not doing something which is inconsistent in a multi-asset portfolio. So, for example, if you're very overweight fixed income at the asset class level and the manager's as short a duration as they can possibly be, then there's something going wrong. So we try just to make sure that we're running positions which are consistent. And I think there's an added bonus by having a very good level of communication across the investment. But I'm straying off subject a bit, so let me come back and try and answer the question. So in general, I think when you're doing asset allocation, it's wrong to have a time horizon of 2 to 3 months. And we do spend some time worrying about near-term conditions. So we are interested in the technical aspects of markets. Are they overbought? Are they oversold? We have our own measure of risk tolerance. Other people who we use as research partners have them as well. So I think all of that's important, but I don't think you're not doing asset allocation properly if you stagger from period when markets are overbought and when markets are oversold. So I think what we try to do is build up a picture of what we want to do based on three things. The first is the valuation background. And we do 10-year forecasts. I started doing them back in the 1990s, and I was very skeptical they would add much value. However, having been through a good few 10-year cycles now, I'm quite a fan. Not because they're helpful in tactical trading, but because I think that they are helping to shape an understanding of the market opportunities. And where we stand at the moment on this is very high level and very thematic, is that we've seen a very big compression in expected returns across the asset classes. So at the moment, I'm going to quote point forecasts. Please don't take them too seriously. They're orders of magnitude. But at the moment, you can get in the US 5% and a bit by investing in just putting the money in the bank. And obviously, you're not be able to do that for 10, 15 years. So what do you get if you put your money into longer duration? You start taking some credit risk. Well, maybe you get another 150 basis points. What do you get, or what is our expectation of what you'll get in the equities front? And obviously, equities are a very volatile asset class. But the center of gravity to us for large cap equities seems to be coming out, let's call it 7 to 8%. Now, is it worth having? Yes. So if you want to make some money and you want to allocate to the best returning asset class, it's still equities. However, looking at global equity returns, that's going to be much less than what we've seen in the past 10 to 15 years. I mean, the US in that period has been averaging 10 to 15%. And that spread between cash and equities is quite compressed. Now, this doesn't drive everything that we're doing in portfolios, but it is making us more cautious than we normally are in terms of equity opportunities. So we probably have a bit less in equities than we usually have, a bit more in credit. And also we have more in a range of alternative asset classes because we think we can get the returns in them, and they're going to provide returns in a different way that bond and equity, conventional equity markets don't.
You raise interesting points about the 10-year forecasts. I mean, you do still see quite a wide range in those forecasts from, you know, if you look at, say, GMO published these forecasts, which tend to have U.S. large cap, something around zero to maybe AQR, I don't know, top of my head, might be 4 or 5%, and then others that are 7, 8, 9. And you kind of wonder, given that a lot of these providers break them down into components, it is surprising maybe to see such a divergence. But then some of it does come back to things like, you know, do you believe in, you know, reversion to the mean and in margins and things like that, which I guess you kind of have to have a fundamental view on the shape of the world for the next 10 years. So I suppose, would those valuations be a key driver of your asset allocation, or are they kind of a framework to think about, or how confident, I guess, is that kind of point estimate for those asset classes?
Well, I mean, I would be absolutely astonished if we're talking 10 years down the road and it turns out that our last point estimate turns out to be right. But to me, this is about orders of magnitude. So I'll give you a more specific answer to your question. But we've been in a world which has felt very volatile and challenged for equities for some time. But the reality is, ever since March 2009, you know, we've been in a pretty prolonged bull market where the returns have been way above the historic average. So I think it's good to understand where those returns came from and why there might be low returns going forward. So you raise some other firms who have different forecasts, and there's different ways of putting these forecasts together. If I'm honest with you, there are some very big numbers out there. And my feeling is that So I'm mentioning no names, but I think those may be more marketing driven than fundamentally driven. So where are the uncertainties in doing these sorts of projections? I think there's two which probably differentiate the various forecasts you've talked about. So one is valuation levels. So I'm guessing GMO, given their view on the world, just think that multiples are way too high because historically they've been much lower. So I'm sure they're building in a huge valuation correction. Another differentiator is how you view the profit cycle. So let's make the heroic assumption that you can calculate a long-term trend in profits. Well, at the moment, we would seem to be at the aggregate level way above it. So I think if you want to come out with some very negative forecasts, you say valuation levels are too high, profit margins are too high, and they go to mean revert. And then you get to numbers which are lower than our very, very, very approximate 7-ish%. So, I mean, I'm not saying our methodology is better than anybody else, but just on the two differentiating issues, I mean, here we are, April 2024, is the average multiple high? Not quite as high as it was a couple of weeks ago. But you break it down, and that high multiple is primarily in the US. The UK is not an expensive equity market. European equities are not expensive. Chinese equities, just on simple valuation metrics, they're not expensive. The US is expensive. Is the whole US equity market expensive? Well, no, it's not. It's that if you look at the equally weighted S&P, that's probably trading more in line with historic norms. So all of that valuation bulge, or maybe not all, but it's primarily concentrated in that large US cap, US mega cap segment. So you then ask the question, are these valuations bubble-like? Are they inevitably going to turn over? And I think the issue here is if you look, I'm going to make some big generalizations here, but these companies, it's not like 1999. They're very profitable. They throw out huge amounts of cash. Their balance sheets are very strong. Unlike in the past, and this is why I think you have to be careful about mean reversion, these companies are clearly not limited to the US in terms of what they're doing. So very bearish people. So we'll look at the ratio of equity markets in the US, the equity market in the US to the economy, to GDP. It's way above its historic trend. Well, you know, come on. These are massive global companies. They're monopolies or they're oligopolies, and they basically cannibalizing profits earned by other firms elsewhere. So it's not what I think we're not saying is that this is the only part of the equity market worth paying attention to. But when you do this decomposition of valuations, yes, equity multiples are high. In aggregate, they're not bubble-like. And the area of the market which is most extended, there are legitimate reasons to think that for a period, that those valuations can persist. I'm also very conscious that at some stage this rule will stop working, but I can remember in the 1990s having debates around the US is an expensive equity market. The tech sector in the US is very expensive. It's a bubble. It's best avoided. And obviously that was true in 1999. And after 1999, there was almost a decade in which other companies tended to make up the running. But for quite a long time, if you had a very, very, very strong view that the US equity market is bubble-like, you know, you're struggling to make returns. And I think it really helps to look beneath the surface and try to get a bit of feel, a better understanding for what lies behind the aggregate numbers that unnerve some investors.
Okay. So, I mean, is that in itself a kind of a justification for a more active approach from the perspective, as you say, you know, if you look at the MSCI world, excluding the US, you know, valuations are fairly reasonable. I don't know what the P is, maybe something like 12 or something like that. But then the counter argument to that is obviously the index composition, and the reason that the US market is more expensive is because it has more technology. So they trade at a higher multiple. So you're in, but if you avoid the US, you're making a call on what you're discussing there. So I guess you've got multiple kind of competing forces there. So how do you balance all of that? Or what do you take from all of those points when you're kind of thinking about your equity allocation?
So I think if you're looking at the valuation of individual equity markets, you really have to look at the sector structure. So if you look at the UK equity markets, which I think no one in their right mind would struggle to describe as big and some sort of optimistic bubble-like return period. There is a higher proportion of companies which have lower multiples. So areas like energy, financials, pharma, which tend to have lower multiples. These are more represented in the UK index. So if you have a world in which energy, financials, and pharma are doing quite well, then the UK is probably going to do quite well. However, you might be able to do even better by having overexposure to those sectors, but don't pick any UK companies because you can get better companies to play that sector theme. I think also there's another issue. Shall I spend a little bit more time on the UK just to provide a bit more background on your point? So I did a little bit of research recently, which was no more than looking at Wikipedia, but came up with some interesting results. So, why is the UK just been such a poor performer for such a long time? And by the way, if you strip out the US influence, it's done okay compared to a lot of other global markets because the US has been the big standout. But what I did was I looked at the top 10, the 10 largest company in the UK, and I went onto their Wikipedia page, and I recorded the date when the company or one of its forebearers was first set up. So I did that for the top 10 in the UK and the top 10 in the US. And it was interesting because in the UK, the average inception date for the top 10 was about 1850. You got some companies, so GSK, if you look at its forebearers and antecedents, goes back to 1715, Diageo 1759, HSBC 1856, Shell 1890. And the youngest company of the top 10 in the UK was AstraZeneca 1930, so pre-First World. And then you do equivalent exercise in the US, and you end up with very different results. So 9 of the top 10 in the US are younger than the Beatles. 2 of them were founded this century. Are those just some numbers to throw around, casual dinner party conversation? I think no. And I think the reason that the US has continued to outperform is that it's just much better than many other countries in generating new industries and successful new firms in those industries. And the UK still has this rather antiquated market structure, which doesn't mean it underperforms all the time, but it's problematic in generating the same sort of returns when you're competing against much younger companies elsewhere. And I think the UK's got a fundamental problem, and I think this has been much more discussed in recent months, that maybe we're not so bad at funding very young, very small companies, but we're much less good at taking young, small companies, got money in the early stages of funding much further. So an example, there's a company called Immunocore. It's a UK company, biotech. And in its early stages, it was funded in the UK. And it carried on growing quite quickly, couldn't get the funding in the UK, so it went to the US, floated in 2021. I think it's come off a bit recently, but at one stage, it would have just about been big enough to get into the FTSE 100. But it didn't, because we don't have the capital market structure which allows us to fund firms which then grow in the UK. I don't think we're the only country which has this problem, by the way, but I think it does mean that when you're looking at, well, the UK is a cheap equity market, why don't you put your money in there? that you really have to look beneath the surface and try to understand some of the dynamics that are going on in these markets.
Maybe going back to the kind of the point estimates again from an asset allocation perspective, and you were talking about, you know, obviously higher cash rates at the moment, presumably, you know, they probably won't last forever, but also, you know, relatively attractive yields in credit versus equities, and maybe arguing for a higher credit in portfolios. I'm just thinking from an asset allocation perspective, again, how do you balance, you know, in the last decade, we had this very distinct negative correlation between bonds and equities. And now we've moved into an environment where bonds and equities are more positively correlated. And obviously, credit will tend to be probably more positively correlated with equities and government bonds anyway. So, you know, balancing kind of higher and more attractive yields within a portfolio versus maybe a less attractive, potentially correlation profile. Is that something that you would build in terms of portfolio construction?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the reasons why we have built up alternatives in multi-asset portfolios is to cater to that point. So I do think it's an issue, but I think one has to be very careful in talking about the correlation between bonds and equities because it's not stable. So if you go back to the pre-1998 period, it was different from what it was in the period 1998 to when we had the inflation shock, COVID-related inflation shock. And I think what's going on is in periods where you have inflation shocks, so either positive or negative, that tends to lead to the correlation between bonds and equity returns being positive. So if inflation goes up a lot, well, duh, it's not very good for bonds. Typically not good for equities for all sorts of reasons. So you don't get much diversification in those periods. If we're in a world which is dominated by real shocks, so shocks to the economy rather than inflation, and very crudely, a positive growth shock tends to be good for equities and bad for bonds. So in periods where you get those real economy shocks dominating inflation shocks, you do get the diversification. And inflation shocks are nasty for all sorts of reasons. One reason being that it's much harder to get diversification. And that's why I was running some numbers last year. I think 2022, I went back to about 1870. And if you just assumed a 60-40 equity bond portfolio and looked at the returns in real terms, that was the fifth or the sixth worst year since for 150 years or so. So I think, yeah, we do take account of this. And I think we have to take a view. And our views, they're not black and white views. They're always shades of gray because the world's a difficult place. And by all means, have black or white views when they're justified. A lot of the time, one has to be, I think, a bit more careful. So it would not surprise me if the period we've had where inflation shocks and their unwinding tended to dominate, dissipate somewhat. We go back into the to the previous environment where we got a bit more diversification. But against that, there are some reasons to think that on a 10-year time horizon, maybe inflation's going to be a bit higher than it has been in the past. But that's more a prospective return story necessarily rather than a correlation story if that process happens relatively slowly.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, you touch on kind of taking a view and some of the structural changes. And I guess that's maybe the next question in terms of what is your view on maybe some of these factors and how important is that in terms of formulating portfolios? And I'm thinking in terms of the factors that people normally point to would be, you know, deglobalization, rising defense spending, you know, geopolitical risk, nearshoring, you know, the fact, as you're saying, that we're, you know, I suppose the question is, will we have more periodic supply shocks, whereas demand constraints was primarily the driver in the last decade? And if so, then that would point to that kind of positive correlation between bond and equities, and also periodic jumps up in commodities. Is that something you subscribe to, and is that something then that you build into portfolios?
Yeah, I think it's very important because what I don't want to do is give the impression that we sit down occasionally, come up with some numbers, and then build portfolios on the back of them. So, you know, I think it's important to do that, because if you don't do it, it's possible to miss some really important big pictures. So whatever happens in the next 10 years, I think it is going to turn out to be the case that equity returns if you're investing global equities are going to be materially less than they've been over the past 10 or 15 years, even if equities are still the best performing asset class. And this compression in returns between cash, credit, equities, moving into the same space-ish, I feel comfortable that those are going to be features of the environment. But yeah, we spent quite a lot of time thinking about these longer-term themes, because it's not just what we're doing in asset allocation, but it affects what credit securities do you want to own, what equities do you want to own. We have what we call our zeitgeist. Sounds a bit pretentious, but spirit of the times. So we try to work with a number of quite high-level themes, which we think are going to shape the environment that financial markets are going to be operating in over a multi-year period. So this is not something that's relevant for 3 months and then disappears. These are longer-term themes, which are going to be with us for some time. And I think, the main themes we're working at the moment, but let me run through them and then run through the implications, is, there's a big demographic shock going on globally. One immediate implication is that labor markets have got much tighter. So there's an interesting debate to be had. Well, this tight labor markets, maybe there's more of a sustained profit squeeze coming. I mean, climate change, enormous subject, but we do believe it's happening. And you can't invest sensibly without at least being aware that this is an issue. I think the fiscal background has definitely changed post-COVID. So we know debt to GDP ratio has gone up a long way. It's not helped that interest rates have gone up. And the interesting thing at the moment is that I would say, none of the major governments are looking to tackle this at this point in time. So that's going to be another feature of the environment. There's obviously the AI theme. Much scope to talk pretentiously on this one, so I'll say nothing. But the interesting thing to me is this going to affect productivity growth? If it affects productivity growth, I'm sure you know that productivity growth has been pathetically slow globally since 2008, particularly in the UK. If we're getting a big pickup in productivity growth coming through, then very important implication for markets. So I won't talk through any of these in any detail, but you put them together. And at the margin, I would say that these tend to be more malign than positive influences for markets. So if you were to do the same exercise in, say, 1990, and this isn't just talking with the advantage of hindsight, but in 1990, you could have said, well, the Berlin Wall's come down, communism's ended, Chinese want to play the game, and there's going to be 900 million low-paid workers joining the global workforce. And this is going to have a number of implications. Like, it's good for inflation. It's good for growth. Political tensions are going to arise on the back of it. But I think you could say basically that was a positive influence, which was going to last over an extended period. And I think it's true, and it was important to understand that, even if maybe one of the implications for a period was to give us a massive equity bubble. But a lot of those forces were quite helpful. And I think at the margin here, from a financial market perspective here, what we're talking about, maybe inflation being a bit higher than it's been in the past, or certainly harder to control. The scope for fiscal easing, which the end of Cold War provided, we're going in the other direction now. So not only do we have a more immediate fiscal challenge, you can see demands building up. I think it's shaping up to be a more challenging world than we beat it. But I would say, the same for the deglobalization theme. And I think sometimes this is exaggerated. It's not as if we've all gone North Korean and we're not doing any trade with anyone. And the world economy for many countries are still very open. But we're through this period where trade was growing much faster than economies were. Supply chains, I think, post-COVID, they've got more of a focus on security rather than lower costs. So again, it's just an influence which it's not particularly draconian in its own right. But I think it's shaping up potentially to be a headwind for economics and markets.
Some other people might take those same set of factors and be a bit more dramatic, maybe for marketing purposes or not. But I mean, from the perspective of saying we're heading back to a kind of more of a 1970s style world, and also from the perspective of taking long-term cycles into account. We had a 40-year bull market in bonds. You know, we had a kind of a peace dividend, as you say, you know, post the Berlin Wall and all coming down, etc. And we're now into a new cycle, you know, arguably the end of the neoliberal order, etc. And, you know, challenges around inequality, you know, and all of that favoring higher fiscal expenditure. And coupled with you know, higher inflation, we could have challenges in the bond market. But it sounds like you're kind of listing all those factors, but still being fairly moderate in the assessment, and saying yes, at the margin, a bit more challenging. But you're not saying we're facing a kind of a fiscal crisis or anything to that effect.
I think that's not a bad way of putting it, and I think it's entirely defensible for a number of reasons. The first is at any point of the entire time I'd be working, it's possible to paint a picture of the future which is unbelievably pessimistic. And I think what people have tended to miss sometimes is that you can't just extrapolate the bad things that are going on now and assume they're just going to be very red for a long time. So I think that's kind of the psychological aspect. And I think you're right. I mean, if I were working on the sell side for a research institute, I would want to go out and make some really bold pronouncements about the future of the world in which I have a high degree of confidence. Because I think it's very clear that bad news, people are much more prepared to listen to bad, potentially difficult, pessimistic outlooks than the more upbeat one. But by the way, it doesn't mean that we're not going to get a bad outturn, but I think just one has to be a little careful there. But I think the third thing is, what do we do with these views? Because we manage money. And managing money, I think, if you're doing a good job for your clients, then you accept that you need to understand the environment which is shaped by these factors. But do not invest solely on the back of them, because there is so much uncertainty associated with each of them. And it's very easy to go from one of these themes, which even if it turns out to be correct, might lose you a lot of money. So, historic example, let's go back to the 19th century. The railway networks being built up in the UK. Was the railway network in the UK fundamentally transformative? Well, yes, it was. So should you have invested in the railway companies? No, you shouldn't. They all went bust. So doing that sort of exercise, it's possible, I think, to end up in some fairly dangerous cul-de-sacs. And I think that we need to have some element of humility as money managers, recognizing the limitations of our knowledge about these things and how they're going to play out. And that's why I tend to describe these as pretentiously out zeitgeist environmental factors. And you can't understand the world or how it's going to evolve in the absence of understanding these factors. But we're not a sell-side research institute trying to attract headlines. We're trying to do the best for our clients. And the analogy maybe is managing money, it's a bit more like entering a dark room and you know you've got to get to the other side and you know there's lots of obstacles in the way. And one thing you don't do is go, well, we've identified the path we're going to take and we're going to stick to it. So you navigate a bit, you hit an obstacle, you work your way around it. And I think that's how a lot of successful money managers operate in practice. They might, in terms of describing what they're doing, go heavy on the big theme stuff because it's fascinating and it's really interesting, but it's not necessarily the major source of returns for that many managers.
No, fair enough. But obviously one thing that you did to allude to that has been a reaction to an extent to the environment has been an upweighting of alternative assets and alternative strategies. So tell us more about how do you think about what one from an, is it more assets? Is it more kind of real, you know, infrastructure, property, things like that? Or is it more strategies like hedge funds or presumably a combination of both? And how do you think about constructing an alts portfolio?
So, to keep it simple, I would say three components. We have a hedge fund component, we have a commodities component, we have an other component where there's some things which are a bit hard to categorize, like catastrophe bonds, things like that. But why hedge funds? Because hedge funds are, I think, controversial for all sorts of reasons. But we have principles concerning what we're looking for from the hedge fund portfolio. So we have set ourselves a return of cash plus three, which, by the way, is quite aggressive because I think lots of funds of hedge funds go for cash plus two. If we get cash plus two, that's okay. But frankly, we'd like to get cash plus three. It's our target. So there's an aspiration element in it. But over the past year, we more than met that. So it's not unrealistic. So there's a return component. The second element is we want our hedge funds to do things that we can't. So we've got pretty broad-based, skilled, competent investment team. But we can't do everything. So our hedge fund exposures, we will allocate capital to people who will just do things that we can't do. And from a diversification perspective, we're looking for managers who are as independent of market return as possible. I mean, I don't think there's such a thing as zero correlation because hedge funds operate in financial markets. But on average, over time, we're looking for low correlations with conventional assets. And that tends to rule out very aggressive long-short equity managers who seem to spend most of their time long. Because frankly, we can buy index funds for that. So why would we pay 2 and 20 or 1 and 15? Because hedge fund fees are coming down. Why would you do that? So those are the criteria that we're looking at. Interestingly, a couple of years ago, we did delve more into the cash plus issue. Because obviously when cash is zero and you're looking for cash plus three is a perfectly adequate return. If cash rates are 5, then you're now looking for 8. So we went through, well, are we going to get cash plus 3? Are we going to get 8% returns? And I think we divided hedge funds into three groups. One is they implement primarily via derivatives. And if you do that, you're getting paid. You might keep a lot of money in the bank. You get cash on margin. So if cash rates go up, you're going to see some sort of automatic fee. The second group are managers who maybe don't implement always, don't make heavy use of derivatives. Well, their alpha's pretty big. So maybe their cash plus returns come down a bit, but they're still going to be okay. But there was a third group who might have been delivering returns of, say, 5%. Perfectly adequate in the environment we've been in, but 5% in an environment where you get 5% by putting the money in the bank. It's more problematic, and we felt that those are the managers that we should avoid. And it turned out we didn't really have any in the portfolio, but it did affect the way we looked at potential managers going forward. Yeah, so that's how we approach the hedge fund allocation.
And I mean, across hedge funds and across alts, how do you think about sizing? That's the first thing, and also, I was reading something recently in the FT advisor section about how UK MPS providers tended to allocate more to liquid alts for their kind of low-risk portfolios as opposed to high-risk portfolios, with the view being that these are seen as more vol dampeners and diversifiers. But obviously, if you pick high-vol managers, presumably they could be return generators too. What's your perspective on that?
So basically, although we run a small number of hedge fund only portfolios, our hedge fund exposures tend to be in multi-asset portfolios. And for completeness, for some clients, more at the advisory end of the spectrum, and they just want to have some concentrated themes, maybe they'll own one or two particular hedge funds. So I'm talking here about hedge funds in multi-asset. So it weights around 10%. Well, I'll tell you what we don't do. We don't optimize. So we don't say, returns from this hedge fund is going to be X, the volatility is Y, the correlations are Z, because it just doesn't work. So We have some simple heuristics. So we start off by just simple volatility weighting. So very high hedge funds have much lower weights. We do look at the correlations, but I think one is unwise to build portfolios or put a lot of emphasis on the correlations in portfolio construction because they're very unstable. However, we do note where the correlation between particular managers may appear to be high because that we may be building up concentrations of risks. So there's a bit of an override there. And I guess in some cases, there's just sheer practicalities that we might, in the past, we've over-allocated to particular managers because they only accepted certain sizes. So, but we're not talking big numbers there, but that's just practicalities and a fact of life. So, that's how we tend to build the hedge fund portfolio. It's a good understanding of what each manager is doing, the statistical properties of each manager. But we're not trying to be very smart by saying we've developed a super algorithm, which is incredibly complicated, which gives us the best weights because we found we go a long way. We can understand it. It's very transparent. And we're not going to end up doing something stupid from a portfolio construction perspective.
And obviously, you had that experience earlier in your career of building fund of hedge fund portfolios. So you've had this throughout your career. I mean, when you're thinking about manager selection, I mean, it's kind of a different kind of skill to asset selection. You're into the realm of understanding people's personalities and their businesses and all of that. I mean, do you find it a different challenge, manager selection, or presenting a different set of kind of behavioral biases, or how do you see that side?
It is different. You're right. And we have very good manager selection team who cover quite a lot of managers who do that. But the way the culture we've got in the investment team at SAP, it's a really, really flat hierarchy. So if you're in the investment team, there's a lot of interchange of views, and I think that one problem in this industry, it could become far too compartmentalized. So I don't spend any time really on manager selection, but I've got a very good understanding, courtesy of the team with all the heavy lifting and all the work, of what these managers are about. So, I mean, I think in general, that's an interesting issue. And it goes back a bit to what we were talking about earlier in active and passive, because there's not much point being selecting active managers unless, A, you've got certain criteria which you want to be met, and B, those criteria actually correlate in some way with future performance. And I think it's very difficult to be innovative in this area in terms of the criteria that are used. I think that the efficacy of the way people do it does vary. But essentially what you're looking at is you're looking at the people in the team. How do they work together? How do they work together? All quite soft stuff. You're looking at the process and you're asking the question, are we clear about what this team is doing? Is the track record consistent with this? So if someone says, yeah, we're out and out value and they've outperformed for the past 20 years, then you'd probably say, well, I don't think you are. Yeah. This is looking backwards, but we need to understand what they're doing. We need to understand that they're going to carry on doing it. We need to understand that it's worked. You do look at the performance, but I think performance is much more interesting in the light of what the manager said the process is, rather than just looking at performance. So the history of people selecting everyone in the top quartile 1 year for a number of very good reasons, it doesn't seem to work. So to me, it's about getting a good understanding of the quality of the managers involved and getting comfortable with the way that they generate returns. Is that repeatable? I think it's a different skill from selecting stocks. It's a different skill from selecting markets, and it's a mix between quantitative and qualitative factors. But I know certain people like to go down the quantitative route and quantify absolutely everything. And there's advantages in going that way because it's more transparent. But you have to be careful in being very quantified, that when you're quantifying, that the numbers you're using actually bear some relation to the underlying characteristics that you're looking for. Because really the only thing you can quantify perfectly is performance.
Yeah. I mean, we touched a bit on kind of active versus passive before, and you've kind of alluded to value versus growth. And then, you know, even the case for trading strategies, you know, does the environment influence that? And you might have said, you know, maybe the environment in the last, you know, in the 10 years, 2019 was a bit more challenging, less dispersion in rates, less volatility in currencies. I mean, would you subscribe to that view that maybe we're into a better environment for trading strategies? And does that carry on into, say, active as well or not? Or would you draw a distinction there?
That's an interesting question. I think I'd draw a distinction. So I think it is the environment we're in, I think, is going to be more helpful for macro-oriented strategies in hedge fund space, because I think one issue over the past few years has been, you know, with rates anchored where they were, there wasn't enough volatility for firms to make a lot of money. And this is an observation, but my observation would be the macro managers that we use and other macro managers in the market have done better over the past few years. So I think it has definitely helped them. I always think that when you're looking at active against passive, the average active manager is going to underperform. Like if you're measuring the market properly, performance across the market is going to be zero. They pay more fees. They charge more fees. So active managers, you should always expect to underperform. And I am, having now been in the industry for about 30 years, I have a wry smile on my face every time I see something coming from a manager which says, well, the last few years have been tricky, but it's been an odd environment. And the environment for active managers is now about to turn very favorably in our direction. So it might be because there's a bear market coming, so you need active managers. It might be because of a bull market. So I think you have to be very, very, very careful about making these sorts of generalizations. I guess the big divide is, you know, the old one of growth against value. It's such a generic divide. I'm never sure it's particularly useful. But we have had a pretty extended period in which growth as a style has outperformed value. And that's interesting. But I think it goes back to what I was saying earlier, that a lot of companies which look very cheap, they're quite old in sectors which it's difficult to make a lot of money in. The growthier sectors have been the faster growing ones. What I'm not saying is this is inevitably going to continue. But I think you have to be really careful of saying, well, growth's had a good run, so value's now. Unless you believe a lot of the growth plays are massively overpriced, and let's say, cash flow-wise, they're not. Strong balance sheets and so on. It just doesn't appear to be the case at the moment.
Okay. I'm conscious of time, and one thing I definitely did want to hear a bit more about before we wrapped up was you are in the midst of a PhD on Black-Scholes option pricing, I believe. I mean, what prompted you to embark on that?
Well, to put it in context, it's actually in the philosophy of science rather than in finance. And people could quite legitimately ask, what on earth has the Black-Scholes model got to do with philosophy? But the philosophy of science is, it's a bit different from other parts of philosophy. And if you want to have an academic career in the philosophy of science, then it's not unusual to get a PhD in a science and then get your PhD in philosophy. And these days, it's much more about the intellect. But the reason I got into this particular subject, there's one particular area in the philosophy of science which is to do with, you know, we tend to think that science progresses because we got good theories, and there's a view that actually a lot of the progress we make is in models associated with these theories. I won't say anything more than that because I don't think anyone would be particularly interested. But actually, what I'm not trying to do is say, well, the Black-Scholes model is wrong, or rewrite it. But there's an interesting theme in that, I mean, the claims made for it are quite extraordinary. So these, by the way, are claims made by people in finance, that Black-Scholes theory was one of the most important theories which has been developed in human history. And you know, you might say, well, that's a bit of academic arrogance for you, but there are some interesting things going on here. So just in terms of some nuances on the things I'm interested in this context is, so there's a view that before black skulls came along, there weren't the options markets because no one knew how to price them. They were regarded as speculative. And then black and skulls come along and there's a bit of technological innovation as well. Everything gets going. And actually, if you look back, options markets have existed for hundreds of years in very different forms from modern markets, obviously. And there are options markets in the 18th century, 19th century, early 20th century. And the interesting thing to me is that when people have looked at how options were priced, the results that drop out, if you use the Black-Scholes approach, is that they're kind of fairly similar to the results that you get from applying Black-Scholes to contemporary options markets, which to me is interesting because the conventional view has been you needed the theory to get options markets to exist. Well, options of markets have existed for centuries, and as far as we can tell, and there's obviously loads of caveats here, they seem to operate on the same principles. So what role is Black-Scholes playing? That's the first interesting thing. And the second is there's a really good book written by a guy called Donald McKenzie, who is actually a sociology professor. And it's a really good book. He's talked to a lot of people involved in terms of how Black-Scholes got off the ground. And if you want to understand a bit about the history and development of the market, it's the best thing you can read. But he then made a whole series of claims, which I just think are a bit odd and untenable. So in his view, he uses the word performativity. So in his view, yeah, the theory created the market. One implication, and I'm oversimplifying here, is that if there'd been another theory which came up, which was different from Black-Scholes, then people would use that because all they needed to do was agree on which theory was going to be used, and they'd end up using it. And frankly, I don't think that's the way markets work at all. So there's something problematic in that interpretation. So there's more that could be said, but those are the kind of, I thought, nuances which might be interesting for people who are probably going to be much less interested in some of the other things that I'm doing there.
Well, I'm sure that would be a topic in itself, I think, if we wanted to delve into all of that and learn more about that. But conscious that we're kind of over the hour. But before we wrap up, we always like to get some perspective from guests on advice they would give people starting off in industry, things to read. Obviously, you've worked in the industry for a number of decades, and on the economic side, on the forecasting, and obviously running asset allocation. So, I mean, what things have been influential for you in your journey and learning? Obviously, you've had a lifetime of learning as well in terms of doing masters and PhDs, etc. But outside of that, what would you suggest to people as important things to read or do?
That's a very interesting question, and I'm struggling a bit because, say, my experience in the industry, because I started quite a long time ago. When I joined. So when I started working in the city, it was a completely different place across many dimensions. So I'm not sure that my experience then in terms of what works, what should you do, is necessarily that helpful. Let me base this not so much on my experience, the observations of the people that I've worked with who have been very successful. I think that they've had very strong work ethics, really strong. They're very focused. They had a strong desire to succeed. Doesn't mean they're all alpha males or alpha females, but they wanted to be successful in what they were doing. And I would also say we're not completely dogmatic. It goes back to what I was saying earlier. The world is a terribly uncertain place. And it is like navigating through a dark room where there's lots of obstacles in the way. You're not sure what's going to happen next. And being very dogmatic, I think, is problematic. So any view that you have and you feel very strongly and you want to back it, you've also got to force yourself to determine and isolate and consider the exact opposite of that view. So I think many of the best investors have actually been quite humble in the pragmatic in the way they invest. And they've had the right balance between being happy to back their views, but are not so deeply embedded a view that they just stick with it through thick and thin, long after it's way past the sell.
Good stuff. I think that's sage advice and makes a lot of sense. So thanks very much, Richard. It's been a tremendous conversation. So thanks a lot for doing it today. So make sure to follow Richard's work, because it is as important as ever in an uncertain world that we consider how to allocate capital well. And so we hope you've gained some valuable knowledge from today's conversation. So from all of us here at Top Traders Unplugged, thanks for tuning in. We'll be back soon with more exciting episodes. So stay tuned.
Thanks for listening to Top Traders Unplugged. If you feel you learned something of value from today's episode, the best way to stay updated is to go on over to iTunes and subscribe to the show so that you'll be sure to get all the new episodes as they're released. We have some amazing guests lined up for you, and to ensure our show continues to grow, please leave us an honest rating and review in iTunes. It only takes a minute, and it's the best way to show us you love the podcast. We'll see you next time on Top Traders Unplugged.